Please sit comfortably. Now, my Teisho are usually focused on a Zen text and occasionally on a Buddhist writing, and rarely on something or someone outside those confines. Today, I'd like to wander and talk a little about Edie Hillesum and her writing. She was born in Holland in 1914 and murdered along with her family in Auschwitz in 1943. She was a writer of diaries, and the following is from a very small portion of that. So again, her name is Edie Hillesum. She wrote, "I do not want to any longer live an accidental life." And then she wrote, "Things ought to be called by their proper names. If they can't stand it, then they have no right to be. We try to save so much in life with a vague sort of mysticism. But mysticism must rest on crystal clear honesty. Mysticism must only be after things have been stripped down to naked reality. Friends, neighbors, and colleagues of Eddie's made different choices than she did regarding the Nazi occupation. Some went into hiding. Some few made their way overseas. Some joined the resistance, and others immersed themselves in the work they love. I can't imagine that she would have judged any of them for the choices they made. Many, however, avoided looking, avoided admitting that which was pressing and present. In doing this, in avoiding, in not admitting, they allowed their lives to be lived for them by others. Their lives became accidental, incidental. When we turn from what is right before us, we often miss this opportunity to live engaged lives, lives entwined with those around us, with other people, but also with mountains and rivers, with stones and rocks, and with trees and plants. When we live accidental lives, we do not fully engage on our cushions during eating or working practice or during walking and sutra practice. Each of you has the chance to fully engage with your one and only practice, with this one and only unfolding life. To practice accidentally is to sit on the cushion and not commit to the one practice you and your teacher have devised as the best way for you to wake up and to fall in love and to allow a true little piece of God to enter. To practice accidentally is to do a little of this and then a little of that. It is to start a period with metta practice, then shift into body scanning, then into some breath counting. To practice accidentally is to go into interviews with the teacher and report on what you think is and isn't happening. Please drop that because it inevitably leaves out the wind and rain. That type of telling leaves out the heat and cold, and it leaves out the mountains and rivers. And it also leaves out the very important sides of your very own self. This type of practice, which really isn't practice at all, is simply being swept to and from by wind and waves. And this is not a practice or a life that can face up to the world, because it is steeped in fantasy, words, and images of Buddhist mysticism and philosophy. Please, during this intensive, this last full day, commit to being here only. Commit to your one unfolding practice and put roots down into the dark soil below, so that as winds and waves arise, you will be, you can be held. In especially dark times, Etty used her practice as a place of refuge. It was a place to return to for nourishment and nourishing, so she could again turn towards the black tide, the viciously barbaric winds. She didn't use her practice to hide, to make believe, or to deny. In fact, she said she abhorred the aphorisms. Make the best of it. See the good in it. And she outrightly rejected any false kinds of cheerfulness or stiff smiling. Her practice was one of stepping into, with open hands and a warm heart, so that she could serve and lighten the woe and misery of others. Thus, she said, lightening her own woe and her own fears and her own misery. But her practice always to also call a spade, and not mince words about the horror and misery being caused by those from the East and her neighbors who joined the hordes to protect themselves. Although she did say, she could understand their fear and their self-protective behaviors. A few minutes ago, I said to please commit to the one practice you and your teacher have created for you. This practice being the best place for you to wake up in, or to fall in love in, or for a true pace of God to enter. And these last phrases, for a true peace of God to enter, or to fall in love with, are from Eddie's writings. These came from a section that I'll read in a moment. In it, she had some succinct, some witty, some insightful, and some foreign ways, at least to our quasi-Buddhist ears, to describe practice. But here is what she wrote. She said, I take a quiet hour or two each morning to listen to an inner voice, to lose myself. You could call it meditation, though I am, she said, wary of that word. It is not as simple as that. It has to be learned. A lot of inner litter and bits of pieces have to be swept out first. Even a small head can be piled high inside with irrelevant distractions. True, these distractions may be edifying emotions and thoughts, but the clutter is ever present. So let this be the aim of meditation: to turn one's innermost being into a vast empty plain, with none of the treacherous undergrowth to impede the view. So something of God or realization or the wild can enter you, and something of love too. Not the kind of love that you revel in deliciously for half an hour, taking pride in some sublime, realizing how special you feel, but allow in the love you can apply to small everyday things. You know, in the Zen I'm familiar with, any sense of an inner voice is understood as vestiges of ego. And so it isn't that voice that is attended to. If that voice comes up, no matter how subtle and quiet, it's attended to with suspicion or awareness, and we don't hold it any differently than we do the sound of wind or rain, or of crows and thrush, or of silence or gunshots. This inner voice, no matter how quiet or subtle, resides in a place or has a perspective. It has an agenda. And of course, we do not have to rid ourselves of this inner voice any more than we need rid ourselves of our feelings, emotions, or sensations. But it is important to know that it is simply ego speaking in a quieter voice than usual. And though this practice of sitting comes quite naturally, she says, still it does take some teaching and learning. One of the elders in our lineage, Gary Snyder, said, and I am paraphrasing, said this teaching and learning requires not only generosity, but a good-natured toughness that cheerfully tolerates discomfort. It has an appreciation of fragility and a certain amount of modesty. And we don't learn by effort alone, but by intuition, repeated doing, and some self-abnegation, which allows for an emptying of yourself and your ideas. And it allows for an emptying of your desires and your wants. Eddie echoes this advice, saying the point in practice is to see through, which does not necessarily mean to understand. We need to see through the inner litter and bits and pieces and know from the beginning that there is a vast empty plain. And in this empty plane, this boundless place, which is no other than right here, in this vastness, there is no treacherous undergrowth to impede the view. And this vast boundlessness that you are can, she says, allow something of God to enter and something of love too. Eddie, of course, is writing in a particular context, a specific time and place. And she is using the language that is available to her as a young Jewess. I, however, as I read her, get no sense that she is talking about a white bearded guy in heaven when she mentions God, which she does quite often in her journal and in her letters. Her sense of God, I think, is closer to the namings in Daiyo Kokushion Zen that says, there is a reality, even prior to heaven and earth, even prior to God and devil. Indeed, it has no form, much less a name. And eyes cannot see it, because it isn't separate from the one seeing. And it has no voice for ears to detect, because there is no one separate or other for detection. To call it mind or Buddha, God or Allah, to call it the true self or absolute reality, violates its nature, because it is all those things and none of them at the very same instant. And if you try to call it anything, you immediately violate its true nature, and it becomes like a visionary flower in the air. Again, this is where Snyder's words are so apt and true. The teachings of Zen Buddhism are really mostly about practice and very little about theory, though the theory and the words are so engaging, and they have led many people slightly, unfortunately, astray. Eddie said the only way you can allow something of God to enter is by committing to here, to now, to this place, even though it was 1940, 1941, 1942, 1943, Holland. So the only way you can allow something of God, of realization, to the while to enter is by committing to here, to now, to this one practice. And then you'll meet her, God, as did Eddie in the pure red of roses and in the horrific muck of shit. You will meet her, God, on the battlefields and pogroms, and in cheerful kindergartens and ball fields. You'll meet her, she said. You'll meet God in happiness and sadness, in laughter and sobs, and in dying and in being born. Eddie said there is nowhere she isn't. And in this moment, I say she is looking out of your eyes and hearing with your ears. But to name her God is to miss her. To think even for a moment that nirvana, absolute reality, Buddha nature, and so on is the reality which is before heaven and hell, before thought and feeling, before words and sensations, is to make this practice, is to make this life into a visionary flower in the air. It is to make it into something, something which it is not. Eddie said somehow it is that we let in love, even a little bit of love too. But she tells us is not the love that lasts for 30 minutes. It is not the love that makes us feel special or super ordinary or lucky that I have it and others do not. One time, a student came to her teacher and, quoting a past teacher, said, "An ancient master said, I do not love what worldly people love. I wonder, old teacher, what do you love?" And the teacher said, "I have already become like this. So I wonder, old teacher, what do you love?" And the teacher said, "I have already become like this. People, you and I, love ourselves and others. And this is normal and natural. We fall into and out of love. We love greatly, subtly, and sometimes in very small doses. And this love is relegated to circumstances, to time and space. And it always has its backdrop, the opposite of love. And we all know from Thich Nhat Hanh's seminal poem, Call Me By My True Name, that if there is a boat person, there is a pirate. If there is a full moon, there is a new moon. And if there is youth, there is old age. The back of the hand always includes the front. They are not the same, but they aren't different either. In other words, there is a 30-minute love which is subject to increase and decrease. And this is the love of worldly people. The ancient master said, I do not love what worldly people love. And I have already become like this. In sitting and walking meditation, in Zazen, when we look closely, when we quiet and quiet and quiet still more, when we pay attention, we find that there really isn't a within. We find There isn't even a without. In fact, there are no walls at all. The other way to say this is we experience only vast space, a boundlessness. It is so vast that heaven and earth are narrow or small compared to it. No walls in the mind or boundlessness are just different words for the word that Eddie calls love. Love, which contains an inner and outer, is relative. The love of Eddie, the love of Zazen, allows what is right before you to fill your mind, which is mindfulness. In this type of mindfulness, there isn't room for other. When what is right before you fills you, there isn't room for conceptions or abstractions, for God or devil, for Nazi or Jew. In Zen Buddhism, and I'm sure I'm making this up, another word for love is intimacy. And my dictionary says intimacy is the state of being, close or familiar. So familiar that we are all known as kin, as family. When we are close like that, like in the middle of the night and you reach your hands and arms to entangle the one near you, your lover. When you entangle with your partner, this is intimacy, where there is no inside, outside, or in between. And though there is no inside, outside, or in between, still, all things pass quickly away. And even when there is intimacy, no inside, outside, or in between, still we suffer and cry, we limp and gasp, we anger and yell. And this isn't because we haven't practiced long enough or deeply enough or sincerely enough. It is simply because we are human, filled with the great mystery of joy, but also sorrow, filled with the great mystery of happiness, but also anger, of enthusiasm, but also despair. And for no other reason than this, our religion needn't be called Catholic or Jewish, Buddhist or Muslim, pantheist or atheist. Our religion's only name need be, as the Dalai Lama said, kindness. Kindness. Because I've already become like this. So I'd like to close just with a few words from Eddie. She said, "For a hint of eternity steals through even my smallest daily activities and perceptions. And the sky within me is as vast and broad as the sky above. And because of that, at times I can allow myself to be a battlefield, humbly available, for there are no frontiers between suffering people. We must allow or make room for them all, because the red and white roses are just as real as the misery, as the suffering, and as the trains that are taking me and my family to death. So thank you to Eddie, and thank you to all of you for listening.